JSA in the 90s. This episode, a spotlight on Hippolyta as the JSA's Wonder Woman. Hello, and welcome to JSA in the 90s, a podcast dedicated to the Justice Society of America and related characters, as published in the 1990s. We are a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. My name's the Irredeemable Shag, and I'm your host, but I'm not flying solo. Every single episode, we feature a different guest host. My guest today is a former comic shop employee, which means he knows exactly how many variants of the same issue you bought back in 1993. And he probably has very strong opinions on bagging and boarding. He's a proud father, a school teacher shaping young minds, and a die-hard comics fan who's still keeping up with new releases like it's his civic duty. Folks, please help me welcome Mr. John Stibe. Welcome to the JSA Brownstone, John. Thanks for being here, man. How you doing?
Oh, I'm doing great. Thank you so much for having me, Shag. I will be sure to help Ma Hunkle clean up the brownstone in case I accidentally spill something or unleash a Badnesian genie. I have to tell you, I have been a fan of this show, JSA Presents, but also a fan of a lot of the shows on the network since I first discovered Fire and Water. And my quick origin story about that was I was a person who bought Who's Who. I know you started, like, I think with number 8.
Number 9.
The Green Lantern issue.
Yes.
I bought Who's Who and read and loved Who's Who. And one time, for whatever reason, I found an episode, a link to an episode on the Fire and Water Network about Who's Who. And I'm like, oh, I want to listen to that when I'm like cutting the grass or doing something like that. And I went to the website and it was like on page 11. And I was like, no, there's no way I have to back all the way up to page 1. I got to that first episode and I'm like, there can't be that many episodes about this. And the theme song played and the rest was history, because I just absolutely love I listened to all of those. I listened to him cutting the grass. I listened to him shoveling snow here in Wisconsin. And that led to all the other shows on the network that I'm a huge fan of as well. So thank you for helping me find my joy.
Aw, that was incredibly kind of you to say. Thank you so much. I love that show too. I love that comic, and that's where the joy of that show comes from. And honestly, that show is kind of what built the network, because so many people came to that show and were commenting on it because of how much they love Who's Who, that we got to know all the different people. That's how we got to know all the different commenters, and they eventually came onto episodes, just like you're doing here. That's how I got to know you, because you left comments on our various shows. It's been an incredible gateway to making new friends, and I'm thankful for that show for that reason.
Thanks for doing it.
Well, today, John is here to help me cover a very special spotlight. This is one I've wanted to do since I first thought of doing JSA in the 90s. So just to give you a little backstory, you know, we've been doing these spotlight episodes from time to time. So far, we've done ones on Jay Garrick, The Flash. We've done Jim Corrigan, The Spectre. We did Ted Grant as Wildcat. And we've done Holiday Comics in the 1990s. Today, we are talking about Hippolyta, or Polly, if you prefer, as the Wonder Woman of the JSA. And we're going to take a special focus on the 4 issues of the Wonder Woman series where she travels back to the 1940s and joins the JSA. Now, if you're one of those folks at home that don't like this retcon, hey, we're still going to try and make this episode very entertaining for you. So don't just check out because you didn't like that retcon. I think you're still going to have some fun. We're going to talk about a lot of good comics, and we'll see how it goes. But before we get into all that, we do need to take a second to thank our sponsors. Folks, this episode of JSA in the 90s is sponsored in part by InStockTrades.com. InStockTrades is your best online source for trades, hardcovers, and other collected editions, all for up to 42% off with free shipping on orders of $50 or more. Now, each episode will select a collected edition to briefly discuss from the InStock Trades library. Usually it's tied to the discussion in some way, shape, or form. I took the easy road and left John with the tough ones. I took the John Byrne omnibus about these comics. So I picked a Wonder Woman by John Byrne omnibus hardcover. So this collects Byrne's whole run on Wonder Woman's from like 101 to 136, the annuals. It's got select stories from a whole bunch of other comics. Altogether, it's 1,016 pages. So, you know, Wonder Woman uses her bracelets to deflect bullets. This thing could be used to deflect bullets. It's so thick. Published by DC Comics, written by John Byrne, with cover art by John Byrne. Most of the inside art's by John Byrne. A few other artists in there, like Sergio Aragonés and Norm Breyfogle and stuff. Full color. It's a hardcover. So it's one of these omnibuses. So it's not cheap. I know that. But you get, again, 1,000 pages of John Byrne art. Yes, please. Normally retails for $100. Now it's 40% off, so you can get it for $60, which is a heck of a deal. Now, John, as I said, I stole the easy one. So did you happen to bring an inside trades pick, and were you cursing me under your breath?
Well, I really was going to probably pick that myself. I was going to stick to our theme, though, and pick something else that had Hippolyta in it. But the best I could find was a Justice League collection written by Brian Michael Bendis. Now, I know I bought those issues, but I don't recall how much Polly played a role in that story. So if I'm going to pick a Wonder Woman trade to recommend, I'm going to go with the obvious low-hanging fruit and start with George Perez. I'm going to go with Wonder Woman by George Perez, trade paperback volume one. And before you say, hey, you got it already, you could always buy another one because you know the copy you have is dog-eared, or you could give it to a friend. And it's obviously published by DC Comics. The writer is Greg Potter, Len Wein, and George Perez, with art by George Perez. And similar to John Byrne, as long as you say George Perez, you got my money. Mm-hmm. It's a soft cover format, and it was $39.99. The in-stock trades price is $23.99, so you save 40%, or as I like to say, great Hera.
And this has got your the first 14 issues of that collection, which is great. Really great stuff, which, of course, our buddy Sean Ross has been covering here in the network as well. So you can read along with Sean's podcast by getting this trade. It's a great pick. Thank you, John. And folks, for these and all your other trade paperback needs, please visit InStockTrades.com. Now, this episode is also sponsored in part with your Patreon support, because, you know, running the Fire & Water Podcast Network with so many shows, it requires a lot of online hosting and other services. And a while back, we realized we needed some help with the expenses, so we launched a Patreon, and you folks really stepped up to help keep the network going. So if you're enjoying the JSA in the 90s podcast, the best way to support the show is by visiting our Patreon, which is patreon.com/FW podcast. And while you're there, please consider supporting the network. And as certain tiers get mentioned on your show of choice, just like these folks who asked to be recognized specifically on the Justice Society Presents podcast. So our thanks go out to these all-star squadron of supporters. Thank you, Al the Comics Guy, Alex Osias, Bill Beer, Bruno Diaz, Chris Mort, Craig Fletcher, David A. Gutierrez, DC Dave, Devin Clancy, Ducky, Extremely Uncanny, George Van Note, Gord Tolton, Jason Keen, Jeffrey Owens, Keechy Baker, Kevin Wetter, Mark Baker Wright, Matt Ev, Michael Bailey, Michael Crouch, Mike Atchison, Mike Zomkowski, Roger Preeb, Russell Burbage, Symbol Pending, Ted Kilvington, and Tim Price. Again, please visit our Patreon at patreon.com/FW podcast. Now, folks, as I always say, get out on the social media. You can find us as JSA Presents, because it is all about building a community of online JSA fans around the show. Now, John, this is your moment. This is what you've been waiting for. All those comments that you've been leaving for the last several years, it's all been leading to this moment. What is your personal origin story with the JSA? And if you don't mind, throw in the Golden Age Wonder Woman as well. Like, how'd you discover the team and Wonder Woman, the Golden Age version, and why'd you fall in love with them?
Well, I've been reading comics for almost my entire life, and my origin story and my love for the JSA starts with the JLA-JSA crossovers. Woo-hoo! That I read as a relatively new comic book reader. By my best guess, my first crossover of these two teams would be JL of A 136, where Batman is belting the Joker in the face on the cover.
Yes.
That means I discovered the JSA and the Fawcett characters at the same time. But I also have JL of A 148, where everyone is blasting, hitting, attacking, pushing each other in a circle. That cover equally burned into my comic book brain. So that means I may have met the JSA and the Legion of Superheroes at the same time. And I'm still a huge Legion fan. Regardless, I remember being a kid and loving the concept of alternate Earths and alternate superheroes. Like Jay Garrick, I used to ask why the JSA was on Earth 2 if they came first. But I also love learning the secret identities and backstories of these new-to-me characters. Plus, the Golden Age Flash had the coolest hat.
Yes, he does.
As far as the Golden Age Wonder Woman goes, I was a huge fan of the Linda Carter Wonder Woman TV show. The three seasons were on television. I had to look it up from 1975 to 1979, which makes me roughly a 10 or 11-year-old boy when I was watching it. Need I say more? I remembered the show had her in the 1940s for one season and then the present day for the others, which confused me, but it certainly didn't stop my appreciation of Linda Carter. In the comics, I was a fan of Wonder Woman in the JL of A, but I guess I'd have to say my favorite Golden Age Diana story is from Superman versus Wonder Woman, all new collector's edition, treasury, tabloid. Written by Jerry Conway with art by Jose Luis Garcia Lopez.
Praise be his name.
You don't know how long I've waited to say that to you, Shag.
Oh, that's incredible. Those are wonderful stories and wonderful comics to fall in love with. That is amazing. Oh, wow. And those JLA crossovers, right? I mean, with the JSA. Mine was also, that's where I first ran the JSA as well, is 171, The Death of Mr. Terrific. Sorry for the spoiler. But, so you know, and I, to this day, I've still never read the Superman versus Wonder Woman collector's edition tablet. I guess I should.
Yeah, you should.
Jerry Conway?
And so beautiful. Gorgeous.
Well, for me, thanks for asking, by the way, I was certainly aware of Wonder Woman from the Super Friends. But for the Golden Age Wonder Woman specifically, I guess it had to be the Linda Carter Wonder Woman TV series. Like, it was set during the 1940s. I mean, I remember it very well. I don't remember being confused when it jumped to the 70s. Maybe it just went over my head because I was staring at Linda Carter. I don't know, whatever. But it's interesting when I think about, again, the Super Friends Wonder Woman and, you know, Linda Carter in the 1940s Wonder Woman, I didn't really consider them any different when I was a kid. I just knew one was cartoon, one was live action, and I innately understood that they just adapted medias differently. But to me, they were just the same character with a just slightly different adaptation. I have very distinct memories because I'm a little bit younger. So if that was on in 75, I was only 3 or 4. I got to think I was watching it in reruns too. They must have been running in reruns too a little bit later, because I remember 1979 when it would have been the 70s version, but still remember 40s. Either way, I have very distinct memories of getting those little paper cups, the Dixie cups, and I'd pop out the bottom of the cup. I'd slip them over my wrist like Wonder Woman's bracelets, and I was running around the house blocking pretend bullets and punching Nazis. I mean, that's I have very vivid memories of doing that around 1978, 79.
That's awesome. I love that story, and I can picture that too.
Yep. I had hair back then, though. I just want to point that out. In the comics, the first time I probably came across the Golden Age Wonder Woman was probably Crisis on Infinite Earths. I mean, not that she had a huge role in there, but she was in there. And then the All-Star Squadron issues I would have bought where she was there. But probably, I mean, the most exposure I would have had to her was during the Polly years. Probably. That's where I read about her most, because I didn't go back and read those All-Star comics that she was in the 40s. I never read the Wonder Woman ongoing until post-Crisis. So yeah, I probably read more Polly than Diana is in the Golden Age.
Wow.
Now, speaking of that, we should talk about Hippolyta, or Polly, as Wonder Woman, as she was published in the 1990s. So what I'm going to do, like I've done with the other Spotlight episodes, I'm going to give just kind of a brief rundown of some of the appearances. I'm not going to cover all of them. It's not intended to be all-inclusive, so folks, feel free in the comments section to, you know, point out either appearances that you really like that I missed, or ones that maybe comment on the ones I do mention, however you want to do it. But again, I'm not going to mention them all. We're not covering Hippolyta. We're covering Hippolyta as Wonder Woman. That's where we're being specific. So if you weren't reading comics in the 90s, in 1997, Wonder Woman, meaning our, you know, post-Crisis Diana, she sadly died. And then she ascended to godhood in the Greek pantheon. So back on Earth, Diana's mother, Hippolyta, she took up the mantle of Wonder Woman here. We find out through the course of this that she prefers the nickname Polly, which has never been mentioned in the 1,000 years she's been alive, but whatever. So she prefers to be called Polly, and she continues to operate as the primary Wonder Woman of Earth, publishing-wise, for about 9 months. So she officially takes the mantle in Wonder Woman number 128 in December 1997. Then Diana comes back to life, as you do, and she reclaims the mantle of Wonder Woman issue 136 in August of 1998. So again, about 9 months passed there. Afterwards, Polly, you know, goes back to being Hippolyta, but once in a while she throws the Wonder Woman armor back on, and she acts as a part-time member of the JSA as their Wonder Woman until about 2001. So going over many of the appearances, so the time travel stuff is what we're going to talk about today. That is in Wonder Woman number 130 through 133. We're going to spend a lot of time talking about that. That's where Polly travels back to 1942. She ends up staying in the past. She joins the JSA for 8 years, and she basically becomes the Golden Age Wonder Woman, replacing those adventures that were published back in the day. So from 1942 to 1950. And really, all of that takes place in like just a couple of panels. I mean, literally, it's probably, I didn't count, it was probably like 3 panels, John, wouldn't you say, where it goes from like, oh yeah, she stayed in the 40s too. Oh, hey, I'm back. I think it's about how long. Yeah.
Because that's how time travel works in this story.
That is true. So, but during that 8-year period that was just, you know, explained away in those few panels, subsequent writers and artists have told a ton of stories about Polly's time in the 1940s. So just cherry picking a few to mention. First one I want to mention is All-Star Comics 80-Page Giant, number 1 from 1998. This was sort of released in conjunction when the JSA series launched in 1999. And there was a short story in there called The Way of the Amazon. And I'm not going to go into a lot of the details of it, but it was just a fun, sort of cute story with Polly, or Wonder Woman, Liberty Bell, Phantom Lady, and the Red Tornado, meaning Ma Hunkle. And it starts off with Wonder Woman trying to school the women in how to behave properly. And by the end, she's saying that Ma Hunkel is, that's a proper woman. So it was a fun story. Do you remember this one at all?
I do. Thank you for reminding me about it, though, because I really loved the new 80-page Giants that DC was doing at the time. I know I bought them all. And since I was a big-time JSA fan, I loved this issue for sure. Now I got to dig it out of the long boxes in my collection, which are not in order, since it doesn't seem to be on the DC Infinite app.
And that is so weird, because, again, the All-Star Comics 80-page Giant was intended, it was launched on purpose, that's this shot, with the JSA premiere, with like JSA Returns, JSA number one, all that stuff. So, and they've reprinted that JSA stuff so many times now. Now, there are no Geoff Johns stories in this All-Star Comics 80-page Giant. Maybe that's why. I don't know. And relevant to this in no way, shape, or form, but you mentioned not being on the app. I'll mention too. There's another one that bugs me that's not on the app, which is the Golden Age Secret Files and Origins, because between the 80-page Giants and the Secret Files and Origins, like you, I bought them all. I absolutely loved those things. And it's so weird that these key, well, I shouldn't even call them key, but fun JSA, you know, collections weren't there.
Yeah, they should be on there.
Get on that, DC. I'm sure they're listening to my podcast.
Well, we got the Who's Who Omnibus because of you guys, so maybe they're listening and we'll get those on there too.
We will claim credit for that. We absolutely will.
And I own both Volume 1 and Volume 2 Omnibus on my shelf also because of you guys. So, and those could deflect bullets just like that John Byrne Omnibus.
Please issue your wife a direct apology from me for you having those giant things in your house. Then we'll jump forward to 2002. Two issues of Wonder Woman Volume 2, issue 185 and 186. They take place in 1943. Phil Jimenez wrote these. So 184 and 185. And it's a story where Diana travels back in time, ends up in the 1940s, and bumps into her mother as Wonder Woman. And there's some crazy shenanigans where she has to pose as Miss America. It's an involved story, but it's fun. And one of the key points in this story is we find out that Polly and Ted Grant Wildcat were maintaining a romantic relationship back in 1943.
Yeah, this part I really remember. It had all those books had Adam Hughes covers and Phil Jimenez artwork and story, plus Wildcat, one of my favorite JSA members. Are you kidding me? In fact, I had mistakenly thought that Wildcat was part of these issues that we're going to talk about tonight. So I was a little disappointed that Ted was not in these, but man, it's such a good book.
These are fun stories. And I will say, Phil Jimenez, the characterization he gave Polly in these two issues is fantastic. Polly was a real character. You got a real sense for her. You got a real sense for her in her community. They're fantastic.
I agree.
Then we'll jump forward to, or I guess backwards really in publishing story, but this is more in chronological order. There was in the JSA Returns from 1999, there was Sensation Comics number one, which was, again, this is all part of that relaunch of JSA. And this was the story that featured Wonder Woman, Hawkgirl. A lot of fun. I reread it for here. Really enjoyed it. This one's by Robinson and Goyer. A lot of fun. A little more cheesecake than I was expecting, but I didn't mind. But these were, I don't know. Did you read the JSA or Justice Society Return stories?
I did. I love the Justice Society Returns one-shots and the bookends. They were great stories. There are some great creators in there, like Mark Waid doing Mr. Terrific and stuff like that. It was like a love letter from those writers and artists to those characters, and I ate them up.
I am so looking forward to covering those in JSA in the 2000s when we get there. They're just beloved comics. Then, again, so all the publishing order were all over the place. But again, this is supposed to be in chronological order of how these stories appeared. Then Adventure Comics, 80-page Giant, another one of those from 1998. This is a story written by John Byrne, but art with somebody else. This story takes place in 1950, so shortly before Polly returns back to modern day. And there, Polly's Wonder Woman is supposedly having her final confrontation with these long-standing battles she's been having with Dark Angel, who's a character that's introduced in the comics we're going to be covering. I reread this one. You know, it's interesting reading a Polly story and Dark Angel story that's not drawn by John Byrne. This was drawn by Phil Winslade with inks by Tom Palmer. The story itself is okay. I guess I'll save it because we're going to talk about Dark Angel in a bit, but Dark Angel's not my favorite villain. Let's put it that way.
John Byrne was trying, though. He was trying to do something to add to the Rogues Gallery, but I agree that I didn't really remember this particular story. I, again, know I bought the 80-page Giant, but I didn't remember that much.
John was trying to make Fetch happen, so
there you go.
Then this is something that I just adore, so I had to mention it here. Paul Kupperberg wrote a book in 2020. Actually, he wrote it years before and published it in 2020. And it's called JSA Ragnarok. And it's a fun story. In fact, Rob and I, Rob Kelly, my podcasting partner, he and I interviewed Paul Kupperberg here on Justice Society Presents back in 2020 when it was published. So this is before we started doing the JSA in the 90s series. If you go back to the back episodes of JSA Presents, you'll find us talk about JSA Ragnarok. So it's a prose novel, and it was really enjoyable. And in there, Polly, there's a segment that takes place in the 40s, and Polly is the Wonder Woman in there, and she was a lot of fun to read in these books.
Yeah, I should own this book. I really should. However, my track record on reading books without pictures, even when they're about comic book superheroes, is not great. I bought so many novels back in the day with the intention of reading them during all my eventual free time, and I'm still waiting for that free time to appear.
Buying books is a bad habit I have. Now, I do read a lot of books. I do. And I like to post pictures of my feet with those.
And I've seen your feet.
Yes, you have. And the only reason I do that, folks, is because nobody comments on the books I post, but people comment on the feet. So at least get some kind of engagement. Anyway, a little social media tip for you, folks. Anyway, I buy a lot more books than I'm ever going to read. And I keep promising myself, I keep telling my wife, when I retire, I'm just going to lock myself in that room and I'm going to read every book. And the likelihood of that happening is slim to nil. But I've got hope. I've got hope.
You always have hope.
So then Polly, as I said, those are a lot of stories that take place in the 50s. Those are all retroactive retcon stories, but they're lots of fun. There's a bunch more. I mean, there's stuff like the JSA Strange Adventures miniseries. There are DC Villains Special Secret Files. There's other issues of flashbacks of JSA. Anyway, there's a lot of them out there. But then let's jump forward back to 1998, once she returns to present day as Polly Wonder Woman. She's back in the present, back in 1998. She continues to operate as the primary Wonder Woman for a few more months before Diana comes back. She even joins the JLA, Grant Morrison's JLA, for a while. So from JLA 16 through 23, she was the Wonder Woman on the team.
That's true.
I know, right? I want to go back and reread those because I haven't read those in years. She makes a few appearances here and there. Looks at books like Green Arrow, Green Lantern, stuff like that. Then later, Diana comes back to life, as I mentioned, as you do, and she reclaims the role of Wonder Woman. That's in Wonder Woman 136. After that, Polly continues to appear as a part-time member of the JSA. She puts the Wonder Woman armor back on when she goes and hangs out with the JSA. I love that she does that. She's on Paradise Island in the robes, but it's like, oh, me and Wildcat are going to kick some butt. Let's go. So I adore that. So she showed up for the Crisis Times 5 storyline, which was the big JSA, JLA crossover story that Grant Morrison wrote that, then led into the JSA relaunch. She appeared in several issues of the JSA series, issues 1 through 4, issues 11 through 15, and various ones from there. Like, she was at Ted Knight's funeral when he passed away. Now, she continued to appear in her role as, again, the part-time JSA members Wonder Woman until 2001. At that point, Hippolyta was killed in the Our Worlds at War storyline, which, honestly, I completely forgot about until I was doing research for this episode. The good news is, don't worry, she got better. After that, Polly continued to appear in mainly JSA flashbacks at that point. She really didn't hang out with the JSA much anymore at that point, but we still got more flashback stories published for quite a while, for many more years. So, lots of fun stuff. I mean, they really made a meal out of this little throwaway thing John Byrne put, I think.
Yeah, I actually was amazed and impressed by all of the stuff that you had rattled off there, because I bought them all. I read them all and I enjoyed them all. But if you had asked me how long was Polly Wonder Woman, I'd be like, I don't know, like a year. Not like all of those you mentioned earlier, people that maybe weren't a fan of the retcon. I don't mean to give a spoiler, but I think this was a great retcon. It was great to have her back there.
I totally agree. I love this retcon. I'm a huge fan of it. By the way, I don't want to claim credit for knowing that she appeared in all these things. This is internet research, folks. I want to make that very clear. Internet research is what helped guide me to finding all these appearances, because I read all of them as well, but it's been 30 years, so I didn't remember. I'm like, oh yeah, she was in Adventure Comics, stuff like that.
See, and I just believe that you have this incredible memory.
Oh, no way. I'm like a Boy Scout. I just prepare.
Nice.
Now, folks, if you want to see some of the images from these issues of Wonder Woman 130 through 133, you can go out to our gallery on the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'll just post a few of them, because you can obviously get these comics in a lot of different ways. They're on the app. You can buy the omnibus. You can buy the floppies, however different way. But we're going to be talking about Wonder Woman issues 130 through 133, published February through May 1998. It's a four-issue storyline. The cover dates were February through May. They were on the shelves, actually, from January through March 1998. All four covers with art by John Byrne. Cover price is $1.99. $9.95 per issue, very nearly 8 shiny quarters per issue. Now, John, you want to describe the covers for us real quick, and then we can talk about them?
Sure. I know we have 4 comics to cover, pun intended, I guess. So I'll try to be brief here. I'm also unapologetically a John Byrne fan, have been all my life. But if I'm being honest, the cover, the first one of Wonder Woman 130, does make good old Jay Garrick look a little too old and a little too skinny, but I do love his facial expression.
So what we're looking at is we've got the Wonder Woman, the old classic logo from like, I'm assuming that's the classic logo from the 40s. I didn't double check it, but it's
I think so.
Definitely the classic version. And it says Deja Vu. And you see Diana up on Olympus, and she's looking in like a scrying frame. You see Jay Garrick running, and he's running by a television set, and he sees Hippolyta as Wonder Woman on the TV, and he's like, "Wah!" But you're right. He looks skeletal.
Yeah.
He really does. Yeah, overall, this cover doesn't do a lot for me. Wonder Woman watching TV and watching Jay watching TV? Yeah. Doesn't do much.
Yeah, which is all right, because then we get to Wonder Woman 131, and it is amazing. Alongside the Justice Society of America, it's got the Justice Society of America logo on it. They are charging towards the cover, or towards the reader, as every really good superhero cover should. You have Hawkman, you have Green Lantern, you have Johnny Thunder and the Thunderbolt, you have the Atom, you have Polly on there, and you have Jay looking much younger. They're stomping across a swastika, which is awesome. And this thing is beautiful.
This is poster worthy. Like, if they had made a poster of this in 1998, it would have been hanging in my apartment. It is so cool. And I should have mentioned earlier, like you, I'm a John Byrne stan, especially, you know, 80s and 90s. Like, his Alpha Flight is literally in my blood. Like, I love it more than I could possibly express, and it's unhealthy. But
which is another thing that we have in common, because Alpha Flight is another thing that resonates deeply with me.
Those first 28 issues are like pure heaven. Anyway, it's not what we're here to talk about. Sorry. But so if I see any kind of John Byrne art, especially when it's this clean and this good, this is gorgeous. This is probably one of my favorite JSA images that features Wonder Woman in it. It's definitely my favorite one with Polly. It just looks amazing. So 131 is incredible. Absolutely gorgeous.
So I'm equally happy with Wonder Woman number 132, since it shows the villain, Dark Angel, in all of her evil Nazi glory, even though she admits to not being a Nazi in the story. The heroes are strapped to a giant swastika, and she's raised her arms up like, ta-da, I'm here. She's got this wonderfully evil pose. She looks amazing. They look like they're in real peril, and it's another one that would have got my almost 8 shots. 90 quarters.
It's fantastic. It really, because you've got, like you said, all the Nazi soldiers there, you know, saluting. You've got crowds and crowds of people behind them. And yeah, seeing the JSA in peril there. And she's quite fetching, quite an attractive woman. Because John Byrne doesn't know how to draw any woman not like that. And it's great. It's fun. I mean, the coloring is brilliant. The whole thing is just an excellent cover. And it just screams Nazis are evil. I love it.
Yep. So Wonder Woman 133 is also fun because it features the JSA waving goodbye to present-day Jay Garrick in the Invisible Jet. He's flying away. The Thunderbolt is kind of flying alongside him. But again, because it's supposed to be present-day Jay Garrick, on the cover, he looks a little too old to me. I don't mean to split hairs. Again, sorry about the pun, but the gray in his hair is beyond his temples. It's moving all the way to the back of his head. They're all waving goodbye, including young Jay waving at old Jay, which we'll talk about in a little bit. And they had to work Back to the Future on the cover too. So not as good as the previous two.
Yeah, it's like disappointing bookends for me. Like, the middle two that we've talked about were amazing. This one's also sort of like the first one, just doesn't do much for me. You know, Jay waving to himself, okay. You know, I get, if the focus had been, instead of Jay going back, the focus being Polly staying, you know, there you can interpret that Polly's staying because she's waving goodbye as well, but she's just as prominent as Johnny.
Sure.
I think it's kind of funny. Alan Scott's got his arms crossed and he creates a green construct of a hand waving, which is funny. But yeah, this one didn't do a lot for me, and that's okay. Not every cover has to be a win, but yeah, I'll take the middle two any day of the week.
Absolutely. And it's great to see John Byrne just draw these characters. So yeah, Green Lantern waving with his ring and stuff like that. It's still, but it's just, especially after those two middle ones, comes up short.
Yeah. And you know, I'm glad you mentioned John Byrne, because Byrne clearly loved working on the JSA characters here. He really did. And that love really comes through on the page. So All right, so believe it or not, before we can discuss Wonder Woman 1 through 30 through 133, we actually have to talk about a different comic, but it's going to be super brief, I promise. We have to talk about a special that came out in September 1997. It was called Speed Force. So this is obviously about the Flash era, right? The Flash legacy. So John Byrne happened to do a short story in this anthology, and it's a tease for his run on Wonder Woman, specifically the stories we're about to cover. So we're going to talk about it real briefly here. So in the story, the Golden Age Jay Garrick Flash, he is narrating a story of how in 1942, he was in a trap. He's in a bad guy's trap. He's going to die. And he was once saved by this mysterious man who came to a window and gave him advice. And this man looked like his father. And this older man was accompanied by a woman in a trench coat. And beneath the trench coat, he could just make out sort of a star-spangled costume. So the story ends. Jay takes the instruction from the older gentleman, and whose identity he really has no clue who this guy is. But the mysterious savior and the woman, they give him advice, which helps him save the day. And they tell him that, remember this date, July 15th, 1942. That's it. It's like, I don't remember, maybe 8 pages at most, this story. And it's a cute little story, and it's about Jay, and it's about Joan, and fighting the Fiddler, and they're in and out. And the older gentleman, as I mentioned, it's 3 panels. That's all it is. The older Jay, it's Jay, come on, it's Jay Garrick from the future, folks. You guys have figured that out. But it's Jay Garrick from the future, and Hippolyta in a trench coat. But it's just 3 panels of them. That's it.
So I had forgotten this book entirely. And when I read 130, the first one, Polly story, they referenced the Speed Force one shot. And I was like, I don't remember the Speed Force one shot. So thanks for the recap.
Sure thing. I didn't remember it either. Nothing like starting a storyline and immediately on like page 2 telling you got to go read something else. I was like, okay. So, all right, now we can get into the Wonder Woman issues. So what we're going to do is each one of these issues actually featured 2 stories. There was an 18-page story in the front featuring Polly and Jay Garrick. Then it was followed by a 4-page story featuring Artemis dealing with the whole Etrigan the Demon type stuff. So for these purposes, we're gonna ignore the Etrigan stuff because it doesn't really affect these stories. Aww. I know. Sorry, Harry Matthews pillow. we're just going to focus on Polly and Jay on those stories. In fact, there's another subplot here we're going to ignore as well. Where there's an interesting subplot about Diana because she's now a god up in the Pantheon. And there's this whole thing with Zeus and Jupiter. Sorry, we're not going to talk about that either because it's not really relevant for what we're aiming for here. So we're going to narrow it down. Now, all of these issues, the writer, the artist, and the letterer on all 4 issues are John Byrne. And the colorist on all 4 issues is Patricia Mulvihill. So I'm going to read a recap for each issue. Maybe we'll discuss a little bit. Maybe we'll just save stuff for the end. We'll just kind of see how it goes. So here we go. Now, the first issue, Wonder Woman number 130, it does require a lot more explanation, okay? Because this is all the setup. So this recap's a little bit longer. The other issues will go quicker, I promise. So it starts off in present day, 1998, with Jay Garrick watching television, and he spots Queen Hippolyta as the brand new Wonder Woman. And suddenly, it clicks. She's the mysterious woman in the trench coat he saw back in 1942 from that Speed Force special we just mentioned. Which means the guy who looks exactly like his dad back then was not his dad at all. It was Jay himself. So he must have time traveled back from 1998. Because comics. So Jay and his wife Joan, they head to Gateway City and track down Hippolyta, who's staying at Helena Sandmark's house. Jay lays out the whole entire paradox for Hippolyta and Donna Troy. They process this whole like reality-bending revelation in just mere seconds. Hippolyta's response is basically, great, let's go time traveling. So, because Amazon priorities, I guess. So Jay and Hippolyta, they hop in the invisible jet. Well, Joan and Donna, they wave goodbye. So we stay there on that scene with Joan and Donna. And seconds later, the jet comes back. And now it looks completely different. It's been redesigned as a proper 1940s prop plane. Jay steps out of the plane alone. So for Donna and Joan, just mere seconds have passed, right? But for Jay, it's been a full week. The reason Jay returned alone is because Hippolyta decided to stay in 1942. So the rest of the story, the rest of the issues all unfold as a flashback that Jay is telling Joan. So here we learn that Jay and Hippolyta, who he's now calling Polly, they stop off at Paradise Island first in 1998, which she explains that it conveniently exists outside of time. So that makes temporal shenanigans delightfully easy. So from there, they arrive in 1942 Keystone City. They quickly locate the younger Jay and tidy up the entire historical paradox in just 2 panels. In Speed Force, it took 3 panels to resolve it. Here it takes 2.
Nice.
For 4 issues, 2 panels. All right. Then Jay, he gets all nostalgic. and greedy.
And a little out of character there, too. It didn't seem like something Jay Garrick would do, but it helps set up the story.
I don't know. If it took me 50 years back into my past, I might be like, come on. Yeah, let's go check out my old stomping grounds. Can't we? Maybe. So he convinces Polly to let him visit the old JSA headquarters in Washington, D.C. Unfortunately, while they go there, the 1942 Flash and the Atom spot him first. So suspicion, because the superheroes, turns into fists. Polly drops the Atom. Well, the older Flash floors his younger self. And just when things could not escalate further, Hawkman swoops in and sees his teammates laid out cold. And he is not amused. So, did you like the first issue?
Oh, I did. Hawkman in the end there, when he comes in, and you know it's a page turn for the last page. John Byrne draws Hawkman like nobody's business. I just love it. And I like the issue because it reminded me of John Byrne's, and I'm saying this now, I can't, without looking up, see which one came out first, was the black and white OMAC miniseries he did.
Oh, yeah.
And by the end of that thing, I couldn't tell you what happened or what order it happened, but a real time travel story like that, where you never know what's going to happen next, but I like the idea of them flying away, and 2 seconds later, he comes back because it's time travel.
He plays around a lot with the time travel aspect in these issues, and he does it as a guy who loves Doctor Who. I found that a lot of fun. I did. Now, I'm going to be a little critical on a few things here, but I want to say I loved this issue. I really did. I thought this issue was fun. John Byrne clearly loves the JSA. He loves drawing them in the 1940s, and he does it beautifully. You know, the Atom looked great. Jay looked great as a young man. Hawkman does look totally boss. Although, I will say, with that amazing entrance of Hawkman, it implies he's the big deal. For me personally, I've never really found Hawkman to be very threatening compared to the rest of the JSA. Maybe beginning like the 2000s when we get that, you know, really tough version. But not so much in the 1940s. But regardless, true. Byrne drew him awesome.
Yeah, I love the way he draws the helmet on the face where it actually looks like it's resting on his nose. I've just always thought that like extra touch was just really cool.
Yeah, it's nice. So the story starts off here. You know, Jay goes and visits Hippolyta and Donna Troy and everything. And like, okay, John Byrne draws a beautiful woman, okay? We all know that, right? And I don't know that he knows how to draw an ugly woman. I don't know that he doesn't know how to draw an overly sexualized woman. Because here, you know, Hippolyta, she's like, I don't know, 2,000 years old or something, right? And she's been wearing long, billowing robes for that entire time that we've ever seen her, pretty much. So here, she settled into American society, and she is, bam, gone straight to the micro mini skirt. You know, she is showing a lot of skin there. That just kind of surprised me as being her civilian clothes go-to outfit. That, like, really? Really?
Yeah, good point.
I mean, Donna's wearing one as well. She's got tights on underneath. You know, maybe Donna, because she's in her 20s, sure. But really, I don't know, Polly. Okay. Now, one thing I noticed, too, I thought was Jay's helmet here, for whatever. Byrne didn't do the coloring, but still, the choice was to make the Jay's helmet gold. I found that interesting. Did you like that? Did it bother you? What did you think of that?
Yeah, I mean, I love the helmet, so I thought it was weird when I first noticed it. If I was looking for a no prize, I would say that the time ripple effect that they use through all four of these issues made his helmet gold for a little while. But no, I like the classic look of a helmet.
Me too. But I kept wondering, I'm like, is he just going for like a golden age thing? Kind of maybe? I don't know. Okay, another, just because I'm a nerd, stupid nitpick. They go to Paradise Island, Themyscira, and they're there. And we see Jay standing there, you know, with the guards on Themyscira. I didn't think men could stand on, I didn't think they could touch the ground on Themyscira. Do I have that wrong?
No, I mean, I read Wonder Woman comics and I wondered about that during this story on my reread because, I mean, there are times when somebody would go with Diana and they'd always have to be like held in the air or floating or whatever. So yeah, I thought that was a bit strange.
Yeah. Okay. So not just me. I do think the idea that that Paradise Island's out of time, which allows you to step into other times, is really clever. That is a really neat time travel science fiction thing. I love them changing the plane to the 1940s style. I just really like the way he played with time travel. It's good.
And he was making the invisible jet look the way I want it. I mean, if they're going to do a transformer thing that she has that she can wear on a bracelet, make it work, but making the invisible jet look like the way I think the invisible jet should look.
Yeah, I agree. Now, the nickname Polly, that kind of comes out of nowhere. Jay is like, oh, by the way, did you know she likes to go by the name Polly? I'm like, what? I dig it. I like the nickname, but I feel like, you know, he's saying that she tells him, I like to be called Polly. I feel like there could have been a better way to do this. Like, have them get to the 1940s and have her call her that. Like, someone call her Polly, and then it kind of sticks. Like, a nickname rather than a nickname that she supposedly had for herself after, again, 2,000 years and none of us have heard that. I didn't quite get there with that one, but.
Yeah, I think that's part of my memory that was wrong from before. If you would have asked me before rereading these, I would assume Ted Grant was the one who gave her the nickname, because that sounds like a name that Wildcat would call her.
Absolutely. Or Al Pratt, you know, someone, you know, or even Johnny Thunder, someone from the JSA would have been the one to give her that nickname, I think. So, but yeah, either way, again, I say all these things from a place of love, so don't get mad, folks.
Agreed.
All right, going on to Wonder Woman number 131. So Jay and Polly, they square off against Hawkman, and after a brief but lively brawl, Wonder Woman manages to ground the Winged Wonder. At this point, our time-displaced duo realize that they're in it way over their heads, and they decide it's time to get back to 1998. Unfortunately, the 1942 Green Lantern has other plans.
And his entrance also looks amazing.
It does. And he looks so cool in the 40s. Oh my gosh, he is just so awesome. So Alan Scott, he corrals the pair and brings them to the JSA headquarters, where the ring helpfully untangles the entire paradox. Which, by the way, this is told, because remember, Jay's telling Joan this story. Now, in that story, Alan is telling a story of stuff. So we're getting a flashback within a flashback, which is a storytelling no-no, but that's okay. We'll keep going. So the ring explains how in the 1942 and 1998, Jay overlap how they're both there, explains it all to the JSA, and it reveals that the timeline is actually starting to splinter because of Polly and Jay's meddling. About the same time, suddenly Johnny Thunder comes stumbling in after escaping the Nazis in Germany. And by the way, another flashback within a flashback. We learn that Baroness Paula von Gunther has mystically imprisoned Johnny Thunder's Thunderbolt and plans to use his power for the Third Reich. So the JSA gears up for the rescue mission, and our future Flash and Amazon insist on coming along, convinced their actions have disrupted the normal flow of time. All right, so what you think, buddy?
So I've been listening to these episodes of JSA Presents and on the Fire and Water Network, and I just don't know why people don't like Johnny Thunder. I think Johnny Thunder is a lovable goof. The whole say you, say me, like a Lionel Richie type of thing where he's like accidentally uses that in every single sentence. It's crazy. I think he's a lot of fun. So I thought that it was great that he showed up. And again, what you said, flashback within a flashback, this story is, it's a tangle. And that's not even counting those other subplots and stuff that we're not talking about.
Oh, good point. Good point. I see most of my exposure, I don't know if exposure. Most of my memory of Johnny Thunder is from reading comics with him in the 90s. Like, I know I read those Bronze Age comics. I know I read All-Star Squadron. I know I read JLA, team-ups, all that stuff. I just don't remember him that clearly, right? So I don't really remember this version of Johnny Thunder that so many fans seem to despise, or his goofiness in the 40s. What I remember are, quite frankly, the charming stories where they use him in the 90s. So yeah. I find Johnny Thunder a lot of fun.
He doesn't come across as, like, cool and we're misrepresenting him, but he comes across is like how I would be if I had a magic genie, because I would say the wrong thing probably and not phrase it the right way. So that's probably why I like him.
It's like if Woody from Cheers had a magic genie is like what is kind of what it feels like, right? You know, and I love it. I adore it. So now here's something that I really got thinking about this, right? Because on the cover, again, we talked about this amazing cover, right? You know, Polly's running at you with the shield and the sword. She fought Hawkman and all this with the sword. And this is a bit of a question, and maybe it's a dumb question, but because I don't know my Wonder Woman history all that well, but is this the beginning of Wonder Woman carrying a sword regularly? Like, I know she's used a sword occasionally, certainly, but Polly always has her sword. And I did a little bit of quick research online, and I found a lot of people are asking the same question. And I think this might be where it becomes commonplace of Wonder Woman being associated with a sword.
Yeah, I think you're right. If you would have asked me that question again, I would have been like, to me, Wonder Woman is the bracelets, the lasso, the invisible jet. It's not until what I think of as more modern comics where all of a sudden she's got a sword, or as she does now, like in the absolute Wonder Woman, a sword that's bigger than I am.
So that's wild. And I want to hear from you folks at home. Help me out here. Was there another period of Wonder Woman before this where Wonder Woman, and I realize she's not Diana, I know that, but still, she's Wonder Woman. Was there another period where she carried a sword regularly? I'd be interested to know. So Baroness Paula von Gunther reminds me of the character from Indiana Jones The Last Crusade, Elsa Schneider. Like she starts off with Dr. Jones helping him, and then we find out she's a Nazi scientist. She reminds me a lot of that character in here. And by the way, we should say, you're just in case you're, because we're just blowing through this, your JSA roll call, in case you're wondering, is Alan Scott Green Lantern, Jay Garrick the Flash, Al Pratt the Atom, Carter Hall Hawkman, Johnny Thunder as Thunderbolt, plus Hippolyta as Wonder Woman, and the older Jay Garrick from 1998. They talked about bringing in the other JSA members, but they thought, given the timeline collapsing, it'd probably be a better idea not to.
Well, and that's what they say too, but I would have just loved to see John Byrne draw more of them.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. But I mean, come on. If they're going to Germany, which is they're getting ready to do, bring the Spectre and Dr. Fate, please. You really get this done. So, all right. So Wonder Woman number 132 in Germany, Baroness Paula von Gunther taps into the Badnesian Thunderbolt's power and transforms herself into the mystical entity known as Dark Angel, complete with alabaster skin, flowing black hair, and a revealing red dress that would distract even the most celibate man, quite frankly. And now a mystical force of destruction, she pledges her power to Hitler himself. Meanwhile, the JSA arrive overseas, and do not bother asking me why they're not affected by the Spear of Destiny, because I can't answer that question either, quite frankly. The JSA, they shoot down several Nazi aircraft, they cross paths with Sergeant Rock and Easy Company, they locate the Baroness's castle, and are immediately captured.
They do sort of explain the Spear of Destiny in the same way they explain a lot of stuff in here. It's like, well, we changed the timeline just by being here, Polly, so maybe you should stay for 8 more years.
That's a good point. This particular issue, not a lot happens in the JSA storyline. There's a lot more with the demon story and with Diana and the Pantheon. So the JSA don't get as much in this issue. The biggest thing in here really is the coming of Dark Angel. And then John Byrne also used 2.5 pages to recap the JSA story from the issue before. So, I mean, it's John Byrne has never met a recap he didn't love. But So the Spear of Destiny. So there is kind of an explanation in here. All right. Sort of kind of. I didn't find it till the third time I read these issues. But so they actually mentioned it a couple times. At one point, they're like, didn't Hitler and his goons have magic spells and whatnot protecting them from superheroes? And then someone else says, any sign of the mystical barriers Herr Hitler has set up around his playpen? So they know that barrier is supposed to be there. Later, there is a one line that I caught again just the other day that I missed the first two times reading it. Or Dark Angel says, you have been allowed to enter the Fatherland because I wished it.
Nice catch.
However, it's a lie. Because the JSA are already in Germany shooting down Nazi planes before the Baroness even transforms into Dark Angel. So it doesn't work. So
because time ripple.
Okay, that works. Okay, yep, fair enough. So... All right, again, saying all these things from a place of love, folks. Remember, John Byrne artwork is programmed into my DNA. By the way, I should have mentioned earlier. Okay, when I think of Wonder Woman in general, just Wonder Woman as a whole, from the comic books, believe it or not, my imprinted version of Wonder Woman in my head is John Byrne's version of Wonder Woman, the Diana version, with like the two big stars on the briefs and things like that. I don't know why, because I mean, obviously there's all the George Perez stuff out there. There's a million different artists, but for whatever, and I don't even necessarily say that the John Byrne run is great. It's just whatever reason, John Byrne drawing Wonder Woman when he was doing those issues, when it was Diana, just that is my version of Wonder Woman in my head. I just think she looks great. I love her build. I love her stature. I love the long, crazy hair that Byrne draws. I don't know why. I just love it.
I'm with you on all of that. I mean, I actually really enjoyed the run. I like the stuff, the characters that he introduced. Mentioned Dark Angel, him trying to create a rogues gallery. There's part in there where like she fights Clayface because she's made of clay. There's some good stuff in there. So John Byrne did a really good job.
All right. Well, good. I'm glad I'm not the only one that likes his version of her. Okay, so Sergeant Rock and Easy Company. All right, I'm going to call foul on this one. I love seeing them. I love seeing them. Because they do nothing. They're simply there because Byrne clearly wants to draw them. It is, sadly, it's a wasted cameo. So, yeah,
but it's a cameo by John Byrne. So I was so happy. I mean, there's like a little sure shot there. And I didn't read war comics growing up. But as I got older and I look back on them, and now the ones that I've bought and the ones that I've read, I consider myself like a retroactive Sergeant Rock fan. And okay. So seeing Easy Company in there, it's kind of like seeing Etrigan in the backup story too, because it's just great to see him draw those characters.
Yeah. I mean, it is fun. It does bring me joy because I do like Sergeant Rock. But then when I realized they didn't do anything, I was mad. But so here we get the coming of Dark Angel, and woo, she is distractingly sexy.
Yes.
My goodness, John. So I did, because I'm a jerk, I did a little research and I found that John Byrne got divorced about 3 years before these comics were created. And if you sit here and you look at Dark Angel, you look at, you know, the way he drew Artemis, the way he draws Diana, the way even Donna Troy, who's just in regular plain clothes, quite frankly, still looks sexy as hell. Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering if, you know, maybe there's a reason John was drawing women hypersexualized at this point after being alone for 3 years. Just saying.
You think?
But on the flip side, bless you, John, for drawing them. We appreciate it.
Yeah, I mean, Wonder Woman's Rogues Gallery is usually like Cheetah, Angleman, and Giganta. And if you can add Dark Angel, even if it's just because of the John Byrne run, and she looks like that, I welcome her into the fold.
All right. All right, so now I'm going to recap the final issue. This one's a little bit longer, too, because a lot happens. But the final issue is Wonder Woman number 133. The JSA are trapped inside a mystical wooden cube inside Dark Angel's German castle, unable to escape. So here, Dark Angel, she demonstrates her sadistic side. She demands the JSA team choose which of their members will die first for the entertainment of Hitler and the Nazi elite. Now, while the heroes strategize, Dark Angel forces the Badnesian Thunderbolt to raise the entire castle miles up into the sky. Because if you're going to menace the Justice Society, you might as well add altitude. The JSA, they make their grim choice, and Hawkman volunteers to be the victim. So, Dark Angel pulls him magically out of the cube, so he's outside the cube now, and this is when the twist is revealed. It isn't Hawkman. It's actually Alan Scott, Green Lantern, in Hawkman's costume. So he frees the Thunderbolt. Thunderbolt shatters the wooden cube. The JSA are freed, and they begin to dismantle the Nazi forces in quick order. Wonder Woman confronts Dark Angel, who then promptly vanishes with a promise of future trouble. And while the castle's still floating high above the earth, the Thunderbolt prepares to drop it, seemingly ending Hitler on the spot.
Yep.
But future Jay, he intervenes. He insists that history must unfold as it originally did. If they change the outcome of World War II now, the 1998, when they return, it could be far worse.
Even though he was the one whose idea was to go check out their old headquarters, and what harm could they cause?
Thanks, Jay. Back in Washington, D.C., after this is all over, Jay and Hippolyta, they remain in 1942 for a week to ensure that the timeline has stabilized. When it's time to leave, Polly chooses to stay behind and aid the JSA. So here, you know, we end our flashback. In 1998, Jay is again, remember, he's telling all this tale to his wife, Joan. He finishes the tale, and he shows Joan an encyclopedia that has been changed. The encyclopedia now reflects that Queen Hippolyta was the Wonder Woman of World War II and an active member in the JSA. And then right on cue, as you said earlier, because time travel, Polly returns to 1998. She walks in, and she reveals that she spent 8 years in the past with the JSA, from 1942 to 1950.
Yep.
So that's the issue. Now, I will share one other quick thing. So there is this other subplot running through the story about Donna Troy. And it's worth mentioning because it involves Dark Angel. So threaded throughout these issues is there's a very disturbing, quite frankly, subplot about Donna Troy, where we keep meeting multiple versions of Donna, including like alternate incarnations where she's blonde, living an entirely different life. And in each reality, tragedy strikes her and Dark Angel appears when she's at her lowest ebb. Dark Angel explains to Donna that the pattern is each time Donna reaches rock bottom, the timeline resets and she begins again. It's a cycle of suffering designed for one purpose, and that is to punish Hippolyta. Then there's a really hard-hitting moment for us as the reader when the Donna we know, she's simply erased from existence. Like Jay Garrick and Joan Garrick are speaking with her 1 second, and the next, Donna's gone, and they literally have no memory she ever existed. Now, all of this is going to lead to the next storyline of Wonder Woman called Who's Donna Troy? Because that concept has never been explored in comics before. So I hope you can hear my eyes rolling at that one. But so what'd you think of this finale, buddy?
So I know your eyes were rolling, and I know that who is Donna Troy storyline has been done and redone, but I actually really liked what John Byrne does later explaining who Donna Troy is. And I'm not going to say it on here in case people don't know, because it's worth reading the omnibus that Shag was trying to talk you into before. Sometimes I always thought John Byrne was going to eliminate other storylines because he knew better, but I thought he had a really good idea of explaining Donna Troy, who in all honesty had such a confusing past. It's like Hawkman's. So right. I really thought at the time, this is really a good way to explain Donna Troy.
I'll get there halfway with you, which is, I did like that story about how he explained Donna Troy and why her origin was so confusing and everything. And yeah, okay, it kind of works. But the thing that is unforgivable for me is he erased her memory. And she did not remember, like, her relationship with Kyle.
Okay.
And all that kind of stuff disappeared. And the Donna Troy, Kyle Rayner romance was so close to my heart. I just loved it that it just broke my heart that she didn't remember that romance anymore. I think she also forgot some other romances too, if I recall correctly. She forgot a lot of stuff. And it just, that really, really bothered me. So,
well, but. And John Byrne, I think, was the one who got rid of Terry Long and her kid and wasn't exactly subtle about that either. So he definitely was working out some things on some of these issues. That's for sure.
I didn't even think about that. Okay. Let's see. For these issues, I like the time travel aspect that the older Jay Garrick has no recollection of these events in the past until they happen. And then when they meet Sergeant Rock, for example, suddenly in his brain, it's like pieces of a jigsaw puzzle dropping into place is how he describes it. That's really cool. I like that.
I like that too. And I'm not making light of that, but it made me think of Bill and Ted movies where he'd be like, I have to remember to put my keys over here and then reach over here and my keys. Are there, but I thought it was a really good way. Joan Garrick, who I adore, she's in this story just so he has somebody to talk to, and she understands a lot more of this stuff than I think Joan Garrick normally would have, and she's great for advancing the multiple flashback plots. But yeah, she's really helpful to the reader try to figure out what's going on.
Oh yeah, she's absolutely us in the story, without a doubt. And I'm a huge fan of Joan Garrick, so I was thrilled to see her there. Because again, coming from a place of love, a couple of nitpicks, like in 1942, Alan Scott yelled when Dark Angel shows up, he goes, Dark Angel! He doesn't know who Dark Angel is. They've never met her. And then Dark Angel looks at Wonder Woman and says, Wonder Woman. Like, she doesn't know Wonder Woman. That doesn't work.
I'm going with Time Ripple again.
Oh, jeez. Oh, jeez. It's like talking to a Doctor Who fan. Mm-hmm. This is a bit of a genuine complaint. I don't feel like Wonder Woman gets a lot to do in the Nazi resolution. She's there and she's fighting, but really the stars of that issue are Green Lantern and Thunderbolt. She doesn't really have a lot of her own agency in the comic. It feels like we're reading a JSA adventure, not a Wonder Woman adventure, which is probably fine, except that's not whose name's on the front of the comic.
No, I agree with that. I think that's a valid point, is that she doesn't really have a lot to do.
She does in the other issues. It's just this issue in particular that she doesn't get a lot. Then okay, the big ethical question, right? Because Thunderbolt is ready to kill Hitler and the Nazi elite. He's going to throw the castle to the ground in 1942 and kill them all. And Jay's like, no, you can't do that. You might mess up 1998 and make it worse. I gotta say, if they killed Hitler in 1942, the world might have been a better place. I'm just saying, clearly Jay is trying to avoid killing Hitler here, truthfully, to protect his timeline, not necessarily the world. So,
good point.
Yeah, not a good look, Jay. Not a good look saving Hitler. Just saying.
You're not wrong, but I think John Byrne tells the same story when Nick Fury goes back to kill Hitler in that issue of Fantastic Four, And it does kind of make it hard for the whole suspension of disbelief if all of a sudden they're doing that. But I think you have a really good point.
I mean, I'm not a fan of murder. I don't want to be misconstrued. It's not the murder I'm okay with, but anytime you can stop a Nazi from being right. a Nazi, I think yeah. that's a good thing.
So. I think that's a valid, punching Nazis is a good thing.
Yep, yep. I noticed you gasping in the recap there, Green Lantern and Hawkman swapping costumes. That's a lot of fun. I like that. It also points out the benefits of secret identity. So that was fun.
Yeah, and it was the Atom who actually gave him the idea because he made some comment about if only your ring was on the outside of the box. And they're like, hey, because the Atom really had nothing to do with this story. So it was nice that he's the one who saved all their lives.
Yeah, poor Atom. The only thing he had in the, I didn't think about that, but yeah, the only thing he does in the whole issue, all three or four issues, is pretty much get beat up by Wonder Woman. So,
yeah. Yep.
All right, so big picture, Dark Angel. And, you know, she continues in the Wonder Woman issues for a while. She was in that Adventure Comics story I read, which was supposed to be her fight in 1950, whatever. Do you feel Dark Angel is worthy of being the Golden Age Wonder Woman, you know, one of her big bads? What do you think? Or is it more of a meh situation?
Yeah, I would say the answer is yes, provided you're talking to John Byrne, because that's what he was trying to do. And that's as far as, like I said before, about the Rogues Gallery. But yeah, she's not somebody that they're going to put up there when they bring up Cheetah or Giganta or somebody like that.
Yeah. She's in the story, you know, Dark Angel, but she wasn't really explored. Like, right. I don't, other than being evil, I don't really understand her motivation. I don't understand why she hates the JSA in particular, why she hates Wonder Woman in particular. We're told by 1998, she really hates Wonder Woman, and that's why she's punishing Donna Troy. And outside of John Byrne's Wonder Woman run, I don't know that anyone has ever written for Dark Angel again.
No, I agree. I don't think she showed up again, but I'm sure somebody will mention it in the comments.
Yeah. So I would be interested to see someone else's take on her, because I mentioned it earlier, the Wonder Woman issues done by Phil Jimenez. We really got to learn about Polly and learn about her as a character, which was great. And I would say here, we didn't really get to learn about Polly as a character.
That's true.
So, like, because, like, overall, I love the John Byrne art here. Okay, I love it. I love it. I love it. I love seeing the JSA in their prime, especially under Byrne. And hey, in the 1990s, Byrne had a couple different styles of artwork. Like the Next Men was a lot more scratchy and things like that. This was gorgeous, clean, beautiful Byrne art. But I felt as a story, it kind of fell flat. You know, it's like it's hard to articulate. I just walked away from the not from the art, but from the story, going, it's fine. It's not great. I can't even. I'm not even entirely sure if it's good. I think it is. I don't know. It's so much of it is told retrospectively as a flashback, and the dialogue, it feels like people are just kind of explaining things to each other. They're not actually having a conversation. So it's like, oh, hello, Johnny Thunder, who when he says, say you, he has a genie. You know, it's like, I feel like they're explaining stuff. There was a quote I read online, so I want to credit. It's a gentleman named Stephen Malman. He had a blog, and he was talking about the story. And I really, this kind of sums up my feelings here. He says, Byrne isn't interested in Hippolyta as a character. He's interested in her only as a source of retroactive continuity.
I think that's a valid statement. I think the idea was he wanted to have a Golden Age Wonder Woman. And by taking Hippolyta and making it that the Golden Age Wonder Woman, you can go back to any of those other stories instead of saying it was somebody else. And you can say it was Polly. But I agree with what you're saying as far as the story. I still, especially with a time travel story, especially with a convoluted time travel story, I thought they were good. I thought the issues were good.
And I'm absolutely willing to sit here and say that I don't know that I think the issues are good, but I still enjoyed the heck out of them. Like, yep. You can still look at something objectively and say, it's not great, but boy, I enjoyed it. That was a lot of fun. You know, Sean Ross, I'm going to give another quote. Sean Ross wrote me a message, and he says that the John Byrne run is pretty empty calorie, is how he described it, but Polly and Cassie Sandsmark as Wonder Girl are great additions. I completely agree with that assessment. And Polly becoming part of the 1942 JSA, seeing the JSA, these issues make my heart sing. And with joy reading them, again, I just don't know that they're necessarily good. I like potato chips, but they're not necessarily good for me, you know, things like that. So my biggest takeaway here for me personally is the best thing about the issues is not so much the issues themselves, is it's the retcon. It's Polly as the Wonder Woman of the JSA, which is such a gift, I think.
I agree. Yeah, because you can look back on lots of different runs, lots of different characters, lots of different things. And what Sean had said in his quote, the fact that we got a Golden Age Wonder Woman and then a Wonder Girl who will go on to do a lot of really, really good things in Teen Titans and beyond. I mean, that's pretty great when sometimes comic book runs end with, yeah, it was a pretty good trade. Like, at least he added, John Byrne added to the mythos.
Yeah, and that's interesting too, because you're right. You're kind of hinting at there's like so many writers do, like you said, it's a good trade or story, but no one ever touches on what they left behind. Like, they leave the crumbs for a subsequent writer to do something. No one does. Here, both Cassie and Polly get picked up by a lot of writers. And it's sort of interesting too, because like, this is 1990s John Byrne, who he didn't carry as much prestige as he did in the 80s. Because like in the 80s, you know, any project he touched turns to gold, right? But by the 90s, he'd done some middling kind of projects. Like, you know, well, I'm not necessarily saying they weren't enjoyable, but they didn't catch fire. And they didn't, all his New God stuff and Genesis, right? Did anybody, you know, follow up on Genesis? No, just John. Right. He did that Spider-Man Chapter 1 reboot that people didn't really like. You know, he did his Next Men book that didn't really take off with fire. So by the 1990s, his output didn't have a big lasting impact, but this did. Yep. So that's part of the reason why I think it's so important to recognize it, is that this really did affect change in the Wonder Woman series and the JSA.
Yeah, no, I agree that John Byrne in the 90s by that point was like the rock band that is playing their hit songs and everybody wants to hear their hit songs and nobody wants to hear their new stuff. And he was definitely doing comics that he of characters he wanted to do. I mean, his New God stuff, I was not a fan of the Genesis book, but his New God stuff, he wanted to play with Kirby's toys. Mm-hmm. So that's how I look at it.
Yeah, I think you're right. So a question for both of us here, as we look back on Polly here in these four issues, and again, as she was published in all that stuff we talked about earlier and more, our thoughts specifically about the retcon of Polly in the JSA during World War II and the modern day, as she's the JSA's Wonder Woman. How well do we think the Polly retcon works? Maybe some of the differences between Diana and Polly in the role of Wonder Woman, whether it be physical, attitude, whatever, and just things we love about the retcon and maybe things we didn't. You want to start us off?
Sure. At the time, and to be honest, even now, I think this was the perfect way to retcon a Wonder Woman into the JSA and not have it be a Wonder Woman analog. She has the correct invisible jet for the era. She can be a part of the JSA, and she even gets to have fun with Wildcat. What's not to love?
I like that. And you mentioned sort of the retcons, because I mean, by this point, you know, we're sort of tripping over post-crisis retcons for Wonder Woman here. Because, like, you know, first we got Miss America was going to be, you know, she was going to fulfill all the roles of Wonder Woman in post-crisis. Then they introduced Fury, who in Young All-Stars, who was going to be, and now we've got Hippolyta. So we've got a lot of retcon Golden Age Wonder Woman stories to choose from. And I like this one quite a bit. I think it's a brilliant retcon. Having Polly as the Golden Age Wonder Woman works so incredibly well. It preserves the Golden Age Wonder Woman adventures without messing up Diana's timeline. And with Superman and Batman, you know, they didn't appear all that much in All-Star Comics during the Golden Age. I mean, sure, they were supposed to be kind of part of the JSA, kind of not, but they weren't there that often. So removing them from the Golden Age JSA stories, it doesn't cause too many ripples for the JSA. But Wonder Woman, she appeared in a whole bunch more All-Star Comics in the Golden Age. So her absence is really felt by the JSA. So this patch, it works really, really well.
I agree. As far as the differences between Diana and Polly, I didn't think that Byrne did enough in these four issues to show Hippolyta as a different Wonder Woman. She's Wonder Woman. She's quick to fight or to slash with that sword that you brought up. So that's not Diana to me, but she looks virtually identical to me in the role. Since she was reintroduced by George Perez and company, Diana has been portrayed as strength with compassion, reason, understanding, and a willingness to learn from man's world, while Polly, in least in these issues, is like a slash first, ask questions later type of character. But it was sometimes easy for me to forget that it was Polly and not Diana while I was reading this story, because she comes in the door in the end when she said she's been there for 8 years. And I also understand that John Byrne drew them similarly, but it was a little tough for me to visually tell them apart.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. The visually, I mean, if you were to just show that picture in isolation, people would think it's Diana. You're right.
Yep.
John did not draw enough of a distinct difference between them. I'm glad you mentioned the slashing first kind of attitude. Like, now, I haven't read a lot of the Perez Wonder Woman stories. Obviously, Sean would be our expert in the network, but, you know, a lot of us have, a lot of people have. So the slash first warrior woman mentality, does that align with how Hippolyta has been presented in the 120 some odd issues that came before this?
No, I mean, what I haven't read them all, but the ones, I mean, to me, it was her mom, and she was always kind of aloof and would be the one that she'd have to go visit. It's kind of like, is Odin as fun as Thor is? And the answer was no in most of those stories. Now they've done stuff with Odin as well, but I understand they wanted to do something different with Hippolyta, but to me, what you mentioned way back before, thousands of years wearing long white flowing robes, that's what I was thinking of Hippolyta.
Yeah, me too. And there are some things here that I think John did put in there. We don't see it so much in the 40s, but earlier, like the difference, she's like, Hippolyta is more seasoned than Diana, you know, because Hippolyta is like, again, probably like 2,000 years old at this point. And she does handle leadership differently, especially in that first issue we read on 130. She is a queen and she just starts barking orders. She's telling Artemis what she's going to go do. And she's telling all these people what to go do. And she's used to giving orders. So I did like seeing the distinction there between her and Diana. I feel like, okay, I can see that she's a different character there.
Well, and she even kind of softens up in these four, where she calls Jay Garrick all the time, and then she starts to call him Jay, because I think what he's trying to establish, and maybe we're giving him too much credit, was when she comes back, she will be more like somebody who's experienced 8 years on life and man's world.
Oh, I didn't even think about that. You're right. She herself is a different person, not just the timeline that changed, but she's a different person now. That's a good point. Okay. Now, one of the things I also think that kind of works, we were talking about how Diana and her don't look that different. One of the things that is Polly, at least as Wonder Woman, she's less powerful than Diana. At least that's my perception I'm getting out of this. So I think it helps to explain by Polly in the Golden Age being of a less powerful ability, you know, there. So because you think about it, if you put Diana as Wonder Woman back in the JSA, she's going to dominate all of them. She's the most powerful member on the team, and who needs the rest of the team? But by putting a less powerful Polly there, it kind of works. It actually works to their advantage.
Well, and she seems like, and this is hindsight, but she seems like she'd be a scrapper, which works also for the Golden Age Wonder Woman to me, where it would be more of a Rosie the Riveter, you know, don't want to mess with her type of thing. So
I like that. Yeah, good point. Now, I mentioned earlier, some people don't like the retcon, right? And at least one of the reasons I've heard is people are bothered because they feel like Diana should have been the first Wonder Woman. You know, by this, suddenly Polly's the first Wonder Woman. And did she inspire her daughter to become Wonder Woman? Like, you know, all the continuity convolutions of it. And for me, that doesn't bother me, right? Because, like, we know in the real world in 1942 or whatever it was, that Diana was the first Wonder Woman. We know that in publishing wise, that's never going to change. Just like Superman was Clark Kent in 1938 and whatever. And this is just helping to maintain those great stories. You squint, you look at those Golden Age stories, you go, okay, it's Polly, not Diana. And it's fine. It's a way to keep it. And it works well. Like, I mentioned Superman specifically because there's people who think Superman should be the first superhero. Yeah, but if he premiered 1938, he's really old, dude. So it's okay that he's 29 years old now or whatever all the time. It means he showed up in the 1990s or whatever.
The people that would criticize about the fact that Diana is not the first Wonder Woman, but she was, because we're of this type of stuff we're talking about. She was, until her mom traveled back in time and took her this place there. So now memory can be changed, just like we refer to things as pre-crisis and post-crisis, and we remember the crisis even when they don't.
Yeah, good point. Yep. So, all right, this is amazing, folks. Okay, 1998, John Byrne puts this 3-panel retcon in, saying that Polly stays back there till 1950. We get all kinds of comics out of it. Then, and I didn't even know this till I did my research here, this retcon is still in place. I thought this retcon was gone. I thought they were saying now that Wonder Woman, like Diana was, had been around, like the movie kind of concept, that she'd been around since World War One or something, I thought is what they were saying. No, in current continuity, this comes from the new history of the DC Universe, number one, so just published in June of 2025. Current continuity, the retcon of Hippolyta still stands. I don't know if time travel's involved. Frankly, I don't care. But in the new history of DC Universe, Mark Waid specifies, he says, Hippolyta joined the JSA in the guise of Wonder Woman. You see her in a bubble with Wildcat and Dr. Midnight and Mr. Terrific and Amazing Man as they're fighting a bunch of villains. And then later, they talk about in the 1950s when there was the HUAC committee, and there is Polly sitting right there with the JSA giving testimony. So she is still in continuity 28 years later. John Byrne threw, again, like three panels of a retcon, and it still stands today 28 years later. And that is a testament how great of an idea this was.
I agree. And if it's good enough for Mark Waid, it should be good enough for the rest of us.
That is so true. That is so true. Okay, so I think we have covered this pretty thoroughly, and now it is time for us to nominate the All-Star Award. This is where we nominate our favorite moment from the series, whether it's a story beat, something in the art, something that makes us laugh, whatever. Both myself and John will pick one moment at each to spotlight, and those will earn an All-Star Award. John, you're the guest, so what you got?
I was going to award the All-Star Award to the appearance of Sergeant Rock in Easy Company, but we kind of talked about that already. So,
and I poo-pooed it, sorry.
No, it was. I think we gave it enough time. My All-Star Award, which we also talked about, is the Hawkman and Green Lantern switcheroo on how they were able to escape in issue 133. I didn't really think of Carter Hall as having the same color blonde hair as Alan Scott, but I love this idea as a way to trick Dark Angel. And it was equally cool to see Hawkman, in air quotes, using a GL ring. And it was funny that the ring was able to change them back to their regular fighting togs, as they call it, in one panel. But I guess they had to do it the old fashioned way inside that wooden prison.
Oh, good point. And be like, hey, Polly, could you turn your back while I drop trow? You know, I guess. One of the things I liked about that moment was Byrne gave you the hints in the artwork. Like, you see when Hawkman's being, quote unquote, Hawkman is being taken out of the box, you see Green Lantern, like, you know, kind of fiddling with himself. Like, he's clearly not comfortable in the clothes and his hair is different and things like that. Like, the clues are there when you read it a second time. And I thought that was very good on Byrne's part.
So what's yours?
So for me, thanks for asking. No one ever does. My personal favorite is, it's not a cheat, it's not lazy, because it's the answer is it's right, is just the cover to Wonder Woman number 131. Sweet. The one where the JSA is running at you, they're stomping across the swastika, and they're, you know, they're running across the world, and they're just coming at you. They're all smiling. They look fantastic and young and energetic and powerful, alongside, and it says alongside the Justice Society of America. So that is my pick for the All-Star Award.
It's very worthy.
So both of those awards have won our respect and our love. So congratulations on winning All-Star Awards. They are as tangible as our love for those moments. So John, I need to ask a favor. Would you mind hanging out here at the JSA headquarters for a bit just to make sure no other JSA members from the future travel back to our time and ruin the sacred timeline?
Oh, I'd be happy to stick around. I could dust off the portraits of Ian Carcool and Kulak in the Hall of Villains.
I appreciate that, because I don't know, for some reason I keep forgetting to go and take care of those two particular portraits, so thank you very much. Now, don't worry, John, we will bring you back at the end of the show, but after this podcast promo break, I'm going to read your listener feedback in a segment called The Society Pages.
In 1987, a legend was reborn when George Perez and DC Comics recreated and relaunched Wonder Woman, helping bring some truth and understanding to the newly formed post-crisis DC universe. Between the bullets, the bracelets, angry gods, a new city, and a new supporting cast, Wonder Woman rejoined the never-ending battle for a more loving and peaceful way of life. Join me, Sean, and a bevy of All-Star Podcast guests on Peace Bound and Down, a Wonder Woman podcast, where we review each issue of the George Perez written and drawn Wonder Woman series and try to bring some peace to man's world each month. So find a little bit of paradise only on the Fire and Water Podcast Network. What's so funny about peace, love, and understanding? Oh, what's so funny about peace, love, and understanding?
Who's Who, the definitive podcast of the DC Universe.
Spanning from the first issue of Who's Who in 1985 all the way through the Loose Leaf Edition.
Including all the updates, the spinoffs, custom Who's Who pages for forgotten characters, and tons of in-depth character spotlights.
Entries span from the golden age of DC
and into the extreme 1990s.
Covering characters such as Superman by Kurt Swan and John Byrne.
The Justice League by Kevin Maguire.
Batman by Dick Giordano.
The New Titans by Tom Grummett.
Wonder Woman by George Perez.
The Legion of Superheroes by Keith Giffen.
The Flash by Carmine Infantino.
Lobo by Simon Bisley.
The All-Star Squadron by Jerry Ordway.
Firestorm by Al Milgram.
Aquaman by Chuck Patton.
So many entries talking about Ian Carcool.
The Forever People again and again and again.
And hundreds of other characters found in Who's Who, the definitive podcast of the DC Universe.
Available wherever you find podcasts and at fireandwaterpodcast.com. Nuclear Man, Batman, Hawkman,
2D Man, and Hour Man. Who are all these people, man?
They're all part of the DC Who's Who.
The Society Pages. The Society Pages is the segment of the show where we cover your feedback from the previous episode. Now remember, folks, get out on the social media, find us as JSA Presents, because as I always say, it's about building a community of online JSA fans around the show. Now, I have a request. If you haven't left a review yet on iTunes or Apple Podcasts, please consider it. It really does help raise the profile of the show and attract new listeners. All you got to do is look on iTunes or Apple Podcasts for Justice Society Presents. And as a thank you, I will read your entire iTunes Apple Podcast review on the air. So, again, just look for Justice Society Presents. All right, so let's get into your feedback. I have collected all your comments from the last episode, everything I could find on social media. I put it into Google Doc. It's a lot of information, so obviously I can't read every word. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to acknowledge every single person that left a comment on our website and read a portion of their comments. So we are covering the previous episode discussing Justice Society of America number 2 with my guest, Billy D. First up is Robert McCarthy, author of the book The Star and the Space Princess and Other Stories. I had put a challenge out last episode to like speculate what a new JSA or All-Star Squadron series would be like, potentially, if someone wanted to launch one. And Rob gave us some ideas. He said, JSA series? I'll do it. It's going to be a mini-series because the JSA is kind of powerful for a monthly series. He says there's a framing device where Ted Grant is giving someone boxing lessons in the past, but long after World War II. There'll be stories of solo missions and all the really powerful JSAers and Dr. Occult with the theme of these powers would be dangerous if these folks weren't smart. So we end the flashback part with Adam, Wildcat, and Sandman fighting Grundy and the Baffler. In the very end, we see Wildcat is teaching a young Bruce Wayne. And he says, kid, Johnny Thunder had a genie, and he was a lunkhead. Dr. Occult had magic, and he was just a gumshoe. Spectre left a lot of really smelly bodies, but what really makes heroes is training. Rob, I think I'd read that series. Then we're from Hal, who says, a JSA All-Star Squadron series? I'd follow up on the 1999 Justice Society Returns series, which I guess you're going to cover later this year. It's hinted like it was setting up a post-war JSA series set in the 1940s, then pulled a bait and switch by time-jumping to the present. I would actually follow through on that. With Fawcett now fully integrated into the DC, there's a lot we could do with those characters since many of them hadn't been used in years. You know, that's a good idea. I like that. And also, by the way, Justice Society Returns. I am so excited about covering that on the show. Yes, that's going to be one of the first things we cover in JSA in the 2000s. And quick shout out to my buddy Diablo Frank, who just gave me a collected edition of the Justice Society Returns, but printed in German. So how interesting is that, reading the Justice Society beating up on Nazis when the comic itself is written in German? So thank you, Frank. Then we heard from Bucky749, the American Samurai, who has his own YouTube channel. Bucky mentions that the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles have their own version of the JSA, called the Justice Force. And on there, there's a member called Zippy Lad, who's a disabled super speedster who uses a wheelchair. That sounds like fun. Cool, Bucky. Thanks for letting us know. And also, since we talked about Impact last time, Bucky says his favorite MLJ character is the Web, and asked if anyone's read the Mighty Crusaders Legacy. I have not, Bucky. I've read a few of the MLJ books in recent years, but I don't think I've read anything with the name Legacy in the title. All right. Then we heard from Robert J. Smith, author of Petectives. So Robert's commenting on something we said last issue where Dinah was pretty snarky, and we were commenting on when did snarky superheroes truly start, and we were speculating Spider-Man in the 60s with Stan Lee. So Robert says, I think there were a few snarky costume crime fighters before Spider-Man. The most prominent was probably Robin. In the Bob Kane, Bill Finger early 1940s story, Dick Grayson was constantly cracking wise as he was beating down gangsters and henchmen, a lot like Black Canary was in this issue. I wonder if those early Batman stories might have inspired Stan Lee when he was formulating Spider-Man's smart-ass attitude towards his adversaries. Could very well be, Robert. Thanks for pointing that one out. Then we heard from Mark Baker Wright from Black Rock's Toy Box and Not Your Father's Autobot podcast. Mark says, so, a hypothetical All-Star Squadron published today? First of all, I wonder if DC would even dare print it under that title. An acronym that might have slipped under the radar in the pre-internet age has no chance of doing so in these days. But let's ignore that. That's fair, Mark. Yes, the acronym is troublesome, isn't it? He goes on to say, one thing I'd need to consider is what separates out an all-star group from any other existing superhero teams available. In the original, it was to give us an excuse not to simply feature the JSA, but to grab the lesser-known heroes that might have been forgotten entirely if Roy Thomas hadn't used them in the 80s. So obviously I grabbed my favorites, making Liberty Bell and Firebrand, Danette of course, automatic inclusions. I always thought that Amazing Man had an interesting power set and wasn't used enough, so he's in. I'd probably want to use Alan Scott, despite his known ubiquity, and unlike Roy Thomas, I have no attachment to Hawkman, so he's out. Sorry, Hawk fans. Obviously, this is a work in progress, not that I ever expect to complete it. Finally, you raise the question of what era to place it all in. Even if we grant the JSA is eternally tied to World War II, a decision that I think has come to be a bit of a pain for DC, I see no reason to lock the All-Stars into that. I like the idea of a comic that looks to the past, but I'm not all that interested in putting them in so many generations out of reach. Let's face it, the idea that Infinity Inc. was only the next generation of Earth 2's heroes was a stretch, even back when they were introduced in the 1980s. If I want to play with any of these folks having ties to their own next generation, that's already too far back if I wanted a Jesse Quick equivalent to be a youngish hero operating in modern stories. So that's up in the air. But I think I'd ultimately shoot for just before the turn of the 21st century. A fun thought exercise and a fun episode. Keep them coming. Well, thanks, Mark. Then we heard from Martin Gray from the Too Dangerous for a Girl blog. Martin says, it's always good to hear Billy take a trip from the world of Zany Haney away from the mausoleum of monsters. This is one of the best issues of the miniseries. Dinah is on fire, courtesy of Len Straczynski's script, and as for Grant Meehan's art, the layouts and execution are terrific. Even if, yes, Grundy is a tad Peppa Pig. And Martin goes on to say, given the damage Black Canary did to the mummies, we should have had a sequel in which he had to face an Egyptian curse or two. Yeah, could be. Or maybe Carter Hall gives her a talking to. Anyway, thank you, Martin. Then we heard from Super Captain, who says, great show, Shag. I've also listened to A World on Fire and enjoyed it, so it was fun to welcome Billy Dee to the Brownstone. Since I started reading comics in the late 70s and the satellite era Justice League was one of the earliest comics I purchased regularly, I always think of Black Canary as a member of the League rather than the JSA. Hey, Super Captain, I don't think you're alone there. I think a lot of people forget that Canary is a JSA member as well. And as far as a new All-Star Squadron, I was thinking along the same lines as Mark Baker Wright. The original came out 40 years after World War II, so 1986 would work to being 40 years from now. And now I've made myself feel really, really old. So long as the new All-Star Squadron had Johnny Quick, Firebrand, Liberty Bell, Tarantula, Amazing Man, and Robot Man, the setting might not even matter so much. All right. Well, thank you, Super Captain. Then we heard from Jose A. Rivera, author of Underground Adventures. Jose says, if I took one thing away from this issue, it's how amazing Grant Meehan's art is. The scene where Canary takes on the looters makes me wish we could have had a solo Black Canary series set in this time period and dealing with street-level crimes. I also love Meehan's design for Solomon Grundy. A lot of artists would make him Hulk-like, but the way he draws his face, especially on page 17, I get more of a decaying swamp zombie. He's bulky enough to be strong, a credible threat, but he's also gaunt without being immobile. There's something about Meehan's that reminds me of Tom Grummett. Not so much in the artistic style, but having this semi-1980s animated look. I can picture these images in animation and they would be outstanding, especially the final page with Green Lantern. He gives Alan this heroic pose that makes me want to jump to the next issue. I'm right there with you, Jose. Grant Meehan's art was amazing on Black Canary, on Solomon Grundy, on Green Lantern, all of it. Then we heard from Dave Tomko from the website called New Earth 2. Dave says, as a kid, I only had one of these issues pulled from a bargain bin alongside random issues of the ongoing series. When I first read them, I actually merged them into one numerical run without realizing they were two separate series. I figured it out mid-read, which made for a slightly confusing but memorable experience. I'm really excited to read the full story straight through for the first time. The artwork in both issues absolutely holds up. The styles aren't so dramatically different that the shift feels jarring, but there's enough variation to give each issue its own freshness. I love the spotlight on Starman, Flash, and Black Canary, but I can understand why some readers might have been disappointed by the limited Justice Society presence, especially considering this was the first book to ever carry the Justice Society of America title. I was also surprised they didn't lean into the classic JSA structure. You know, the team assembles, they split into smaller pairings, and they reconvene. That formula worked beautifully in JSA Returns, a story set in the past that paved the way for the 1999 series. Structurally, these two projects have more in common than people might realize. Your point about aligning the roster with characters who had active titles at the time is really interesting. If you're reading Starman, maybe this was meant to entice you with another Starman. But if that was the strategy, they could have pushed it further. Give readers bold, unexpected team-ups between modern heroes and their Golden Age counterparts. It had been 6 years since the last JLA-JSA crossover, which was an annual tradition that ran for 23 years, so that's a huge gap. Use the new generation as an entry point to the old guard. Send heroes back in time, and let us see Wally West teaming up with Jay Garrick for the first time. Show Will Payton meeting Ted Knight. Let both Canaries fight side by side in their prime. Give us Guy Gardner, John Stewart, or even Kilowog. Partner with Alan Scott. Imagine Carter and Shiera crossing paths with Katar and Shiera. Those never-before-seen combinations are what makes the cover of Armageddon Inferno number 4 so striking. Whoa, you know what? I was totally with you there, Dave, until you threw Armageddon Inferno in there. Then you lost me, buddy. I'm just teasing. Then he goes on to say, I wouldn't mind seeing a new All-Star Squadron series set within the current new history of the DC Universe, especially since the original run was so firmly rooted in the pre-Crisis Earth 2. It's hard to imagine DC being continuity meticulous as Roy Thomas was, but there's a real potential in revisiting the wartime sandbox with a modern lens. One of the biggest opportunities would be a more fully integrated of the wartime Fawcett, Quality, Charlton, and Earth 1 characters like the Creature Commandos and One Timeline alongside some of the other properties DC's folded in over the years. The Wildstorm and Milestone heroes alone could bring fascinating new dynamics to the World War II ensemble. Imagine how differently a squadron story would feel when a broader IP library is in play. That's an interesting idea, actually. I really like that, Dave. Then he goes on to say there's a wealth of characters created after the original series ended who could slot in seamlessly. Figures like Bobo Benetti, General Glory, Scarab, or Johnny Sorrow could add unexpected texture. And legacy angles would also be compelling, like introducing one of Bloodwind's relatives who once wielded a blood gem during the war years. All right, Dave, again, a bit of a record scratch. You had me right until you mentioned Bloodwind. Really? Bloodwind? I actually am a bit of a fan of Bloodwind, but I even went as far as to give Dan Juergens a hard time about Bloodwind during an interview. So to me, he's a bit of a punchline, but I get where you're coming from, buddy. And also, by the way, huge shout out. Thank you to Dave, because he was so kind to promote the last episode of JSA in the 90s on his blog, New Earth 2, which is the website. Go check that out, folks. Thanks again, Dave. Then we're from Brett Miller, who says, I have a soft spot for Black Canary. The first comic I ever read was Justice League starring her. It was a very weird one, written in first person. It kept saying, quote, you look him in the eyes. No idea what number it was, but just it was either late 70s or early 80s. You know, Brett, I'm pretty sure someone at home probably knows. Maybe they can let us know. Then we heard from Tim Price from the Outcasters Under Siege and Avengers podcast. Tim says, it was great having Billy on the show. He's always fun to hear, and this episode was no exception. At first, I was a little worried I'd be negative about the interior artwork, because that Tom Lyle cover of Canary is so gorgeous. But Grant Meehan's artwork, I was really happy with. It was energetic, expressive, and fun. I do take a little issue with the 1990s view of Canary's costume, showing a lot of hip and cheek, but as I said, it's a product of its time. I thought Grant gave Dinah a powerful showing this issue. Now, I'll take a bit of a counterpoint. Absolutely, he made Canary look sexy, and there was a little bit of the male gaze in the artwork, but by 90s standards, it was really rather tame, I would say. So, just my two cents. And Tim ends it with, now if we only knew who the villain mastermind was, how long will this mystery be drawn out? Wait, was that discussed? I must not have been paying attention. Well, thanks, Tim. You just keep listening and you'll be in for a big shock. Then we hear from Lizanne Oswald, who has her own YouTube channel. Liz says, the Impact line of comics, I loved those. I got Jaguar, Black Hood, and the Mighty Crusaders. I also got one issue of The Fly, but it was good too, and so was The Shield. And then Liz goes on to say, this issue of the JSA art was fantastic. The story was good, too. Now, you may recall last issue we talked a little bit about Solomon Grundy and the look of his face. So Liz comments on that. She says, as for Grundy, somebody's nose, he's a zombie. Maybe the cartilage has dissolved, and the bone is all that's left. His skin in most forms is pretty strong, but maybe the cartilage in this one isn't. That's a good point, Liz. Could well be. Thank you. Then we heard from, I don't know, somebody named John Stibe. I have no idea who this guy is. But anyway, he goes on to say, another fun episode reminding me why I love these comics when I bought them in the first place. And since I now feel contractually obligated to mention the Impact line of comics for every episode of the miniseries, I have to once again give them praise that I thought they deserved with regards to both art and story. This was a solid Black Canary spotlight. I've always been a fan of Dinah, and her fight with Solomon Grundy proved why. As for Rocco the Looter goes, remember, nobody musses his hair. Well, thank you, John. Then we'll hear from Chris Franklin right here from the Fire & Water Podcast Network. He has shows such as JLUcast, and right here on the Justice Society Presents feed, he has a segment called Mr. and Mrs. Superman Stories that he does with his wife, and he does much more than that as well. Chris says, great discussion, gents. Always a pleasure to have Billy Dee on the network. I think an All-Star Squadron series would work well set in the late 40s or early 50s, with maybe a secret organization plot running in the background, building to a big kerfuffle in an annual or something. Definitely rope in the JSA, but give Johnny, Libby, Shining Knight, Robot Man, and etc. plenty to do. As for JSA number 2, I always dug Grant Miam's artwork, so I was happy to see him in the art here. The only downside is one minor coloring gap that drove me nuts, then and it does now too. Black Canary's yellow belt. It was always colored blue in the Golden and Silver Ages. It sticks out like a sore thumb here, and I just want to take a marker and recolor it. I know it's a minor thing, but it's like when they draw Alan's ring on the right hand, just sets off my comic OCD. Hey, you know what, Chris? Thanks for pointing that out. I did not even pick up on the fact that Black Canary had the wrong color belt. That's a great catch. Then Chris goes on to say, I do like the reading of how Ted Knight's mental breakdown could play into this. James Robinson showed Ted was in and out of mental facilities throughout the late 40s and 50s, so it wasn't just done in one incident. You could fit this right in there. Awesome. All right, Chris, thanks for backing up our speculation. Then we heard from Nate the Great, says, it's funny, but you don't really think of Black Canary with the JSA because she wasn't in the 70s All-Star Comics or All-Star Squadron. That said, the Canary did get a nice spotlight here against a foe like Grundy that you wouldn't think she could be. So, all in all, good issue. Totally agree, Nate. Then just a quick shout out to Anthony Cardino. He's still catching up on our podcast. He's a few episodes back, but someday he'll hear his name mentioned here in the feedback. So thank you for catching up, Anthony, and a huge thank you for mentioning our podcast on his blog. So thanks, Anthony. All right, now this is the part of the show where I thank everyone who shared our show on their social media timelines. This means Facebook, Blue Sky, Instagram, Twitter or X, and Threads. And yes, I know this sounds like a long list of names or like a really weird phone book. However, these folks showed their support and promoted the show, so it's important to me that we recognize these individuals. This time out, we've got over 70 people who helped promote the last episode of the show. So, honestly, there's probably more, but Instagram is being a royal pain, and I can't see who's been resharing over there right now, so it's driving me nuts. But either way, if I missed you, I apologize. And you could be on this list next month. It's really easy by sharing or retweeting or whatever it's called, again, on Facebook, Blue Sky, Instagram, Extra Twitter, or Threads. Our thanks go out to Alan Williams, Alan Boyce Jr., Andre Freitas, Barry Reese's Infinity Ink Tumblr, Benjamin Hall, Between the Pages blog, Bill Beer, Billy D in his accounts for A World on Fire, an All-Star Squadron podcast, and Magazines and Monsters, Black Vulcan 69, Brad Dade, Brett Young, Brian Schufo, Carol at Actors Update, Charlton Hero, Chris A. Field from Otherverse Games, Chris Franklin, Chris Mort, Clinton Robinson and his accounts for Coffee and Comics and Fan Film Fridays podcast, Codex Omniversa, Comic Foil, Craig McDonald, D. Kennedy at Detective 38, Dan Dougherty, Dave's Comics Heroes blog, David A. Gutierrez, DC New Earth 2, Dr. Chris Lewis, Dr. Pop Culture USA, Ed Moore and his accounts for Teal Productions, Gentleman Joey, Gus Casals, J. David Weeder and his wife, Holly Rowe Weeder, Javier 1814, J.L. Avenger, Joe at Pretty Bird, John Stibe, Jordan Jennings and his account for Extremely Jordan, J.P. Roca, Justin Steiner, Keechy Baker, Kirk Spencer, Lizanne Oswald, Mark Baker Wright, Martin Gray, Matthew Barton, Max Romero, Michael Bailey, Mike Thomas, Miracle Man at Komoda 1977, Nuno Duarte, Paul Kean, Prairie Justice, the Greg Saunders Vigilante Podcast, Rick Austin, Rob Kelly, Robert Junker, Scott X, Sean Ross and his account for Peacebound and Down, a Wonder Woman podcast, Silverman on Security, Stop, Let's Team Up, That Giffen Show, The Earth 2 Podcast, The Telltale Mine, Tim Price and his account for Outcasters, Under Siege, an Avengers podcast, Venkman, and Zek Cap Boots. Woof. My thanks to all of you for your support of the JSA in the 90s podcast. Your feedback has been such a critical part of the show over the years, and I'm serious. I mean, this community of JSA fans we're building together is absolutely fantastic. Now, if I've forgotten or missed anyone, I am terribly sorry. It is probably the fault of Billy D. I do my best to find all the social media comments, but sometimes they do slip through my internet fingers. So please keep those cards and letters coming. And remember, visit our website, which is fireandwaterpodcast.com/JSA, and leave your comments on the show post there. That's where most of the action's going on. And you can leave your comment there, and fellow JSA fans can communicate with you and share their thoughts as well. You can also find us on most social media platforms as JSA Presents, including Facebook, Blue Sky, Instagram, Twitter or X, and Threads. Or you can email us at justicesocietypresents@gmail.com. And my thanks again to you listeners for being so freaking awesome and for a great collection of feedback. Now, we're going to take a quick podcast promo break, and when we come back, we'll connect with this episode's guest, John Stibe, and we'll see how he managed with dusting the JSA brownstone portraits.
I'm Diablo Frank, and I've been a fan of The Amazing Amazon for my entire life. To be truthful, I'm not a typical fan of the Paradise Island set. I'm not big on mythology, and I'm highly critical of the most popular Themyscira stories. I like it when Wonder Woman loses her powers and hangs out with a tiny blind Asian martial arts master named I Ching, or when she works at Taco Bell and helps collect child support for a coworker from a deadbeat mafioso dad, or when she rides around on kangaroo ponies from outer space and is a little too into bondage and spanking for the squares. Wonder Woman is great, but I really miss Diana Prince, the reminder that the heroine feels and fails and bleeds like the rest of us. That's why I call my podcast about her Diana Prince Wonder Woman, because I like to remember there's a woman behind all that wonder. And I'd like to talk about her if you care to listen on iTunes, Shout Engine, and Internet Archive.
Science fiction, romance, swashbuckling adventure, all that and more is coming to DC Specialcast in 2026. I'm your host, Paul Ken. DC Specialcast is a podcast where each month a guest and I explore DC's special comics of the 1970s, like DC Special Series, DC Superstars, Super DC Giant, and others. This year, we'll have plenty of superhero action, including a special movie tie-in. But we also plan to cover Sergio Aragonés, The Star Hunters, Three Musketeers, and Love 1971.
But wait, there's more! Extra! Extra! Read all about it! I'm Sean M. Myers, and because Paul will not let me do a podcast about Newsies, we're going to do a special segment we are calling The Monthly Planet. I will join my Bat Brother Paul as we cover the 50th anniversary of the greatest series of DC House ads ever, The Daily Planet. Get ready to hear us talk about Direct Currents, Fred Hembeck, The Answer Man, and so much more.
So join us each month on DC Specialcast from the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
Now that's special.
Okay, folks, we're back from break, and yes, we've got John back with us. First, John, my thanks to you for appearing on this episode. You've been leaving comments with us for years, so I'm so excited that you're here, and I'm so excited that this is the very first podcast you've ever appeared on, and I'm really thrilled that your first podcast appearance is here with me on JSA in the 90s. So why don't you tell the listeners, since it's your first podcast, I guess they can't find you anywhere else, but why don't you tell them where they might find you?
Well, and it's funny because our theme for tonight has been time travel, and that's kind of what happened, because I just recorded my very first podcast of DC Specialcast with Paul Kien recently, like as recently as last week, which will be out in April, and it features super gorillas, but this one might travel back in time and come out first.
Paul and I have been both arguing and claiming who, quote unquote, discovered you as a talent, because who's recorded with you first versus who's getting on the air first.
I feel like I'm the one who should be thanking both of you. I can also be found on Facebook under my first and last name. I post regularly about my family and my life, but I also post about comics, of course. And I'm on Instagram, Twitter, and Blue Sky as JJ Carl ST, which is a mashup of my four names. Yep, my secret power is I actually have two middle names. Why do I have two middle names? My dad always told me it was because he found out that names were free. I want to say thank you, Shag, for this incredible opportunity. I was really nervous about talking to you because I've been listening to you for so long. And I'm not kidding when I say that I feel honored to be part of an episode on the Fire and Water Network. I cannot say enough how much I appreciate this community of like-minded fans who not only find their joy, but share their joy with so many others. So thank you again for all the fun shows and great times that I've had listening to you and Rob and everyone else. It's just been a real pleasure.
Well, you're far, far too kind. And I appreciate all the nice words you said. And yes, the community is astonishing, isn't it? I'm so thankful to be part of this community. And they're all so supportive and so excited and so, as you said, full of joy. I love it. As far as the nice things you said about me, you really need to raise your standards, John. I mean, if I'm something that you're wowed by, man, you are not hard to impress. I'm just saying. But this has been a real joy. I've had a blast. Folks, just so you know, however long this episode lasts, John and I have actually talked twice as long. So we've been talking about all kinds of stuff. We've been swapping stories of being comic shop employees, how our lives have a lot of similarities in weird, quirky ways. And it's been an absolute blast. And I can't thank you enough for being here, man.
Thank you.
All right, well, that's going to do it, folks. Now, come back next episode when we cover Justice Society of America number 3. And I'll be joined by a fantastic guest to help me cover the issue. Who will it be? Come on, people. You know how this works. You'll just have to wait and find out next episode. Thanks for listening, everyone. Until next time, I'm Shag.
And I'm John.
And we're asking you to join the fight.
For justice.